So then, she continued, I'll say the policeman wrote it all down in his book and thanked me. I'll say I asked him in for a cup of coffee, even though I was in a hurry to be on my way, and they'll ask me why. I'll say he probably knew about my trouble before, and I wanted to satisfy his mind that everything was on the up and up here. But he said no, we had to move along. So I asked if he'd like to take a cold Pepsi along with him, because the day was so hot. And he said, yes, thanks, that was very kind. She drained her second Pepsi and held the empty plastic bottle between her and him. Seen through the plastic, her eye was huge and wavering, the eye of a cyclops. The side of her head took on a ripply, hydrocephalic bulge. I'm going to stop and put this bottle in the ditch about 2 miles up the road, she said. But first I'll put his fingers on it, of course. She smiled at him, a dry, spitless smile. Fingerprints, she said. They'll know he went past my house then, or they'll think they do. That's just as good, isn't it, Paul? His dismay deepened. So they'll go up the road and they won't find him. He'll just be gone. Like those swamis who toot their flutes until ropes come out of baskets, and they climb the ropes and disappear. Poof. Poof, Paul said. It won't take them long to come back. I know that. After all, if they can't find any trace of him except that one bottle after here, they'll decide they better think some more about me. After all, I'm crazy, aren't I? All the papers said so. Nutty as a fruitcake. But they'll believe me at first. I don't think they'll actually want to come in and search the house. Not at first. They'll look in other places. Try to think of other things before they come back. We'll have some time. Maybe as much as a week. She looked at him levelly. You're going to have to write faster, Paul, she said. Dark fell and no police came. Annie did not spend the time before it did with Paul, however. She wanted to reglaze his bedroom window and pick up the paper clips and broken glass scattered on the lawn. When the police come tomorrow looking for their missing lamb, she said, we don't want them to see anything out of the ordinary, do we, Paul? Just let them look under the lawnmower, kiddo. Just let them look under there, and they'll see plenty out of the ordinary. But no matter how hard he tried to make his vivid imagination work, he could not make it come up with a scenario which would lead up to that. You wonder why I told you all of this, Paul? She asked, before going upstairs to see what she could do with the window. Why I went into my plans for dealing with this in such great detail? No, he said wanly. Partly because I wanted you to know exactly what the stakes are, and exactly what you'll have to do to stay alive. I also wanted you to know I'd end it right now, except for the book. I still care about the book. She smiled. It was a smile which was both radiant and strangely wistful. It really is the best misery story of them all, and I do so much want to know how it all comes out. So do I, Annie, he said. She looked at him, startled. Why? You know, don't you? When I start a book, I always think I know how things will turn out. But I never actually had one end exactly that way. It isn't even that surprising once you stop to think about it. Writing a book is a little like firing an ICBM, only it travels over time instead of space. The book time the characters spend living in the story, and the real time the novelist spends writing it all down. Having a novel end exactly the way you thought it would when you started out would be like shooting a Titan missile halfway around the world and having the payload drop through a basketball hoop. Looks good on paper. There are people who build those things who tell you it was easy as pie and even kept a straight face while they said it. But the odds are always against. Yes, Annie said. I see. I must have a pretty good navigation system built into the equipment, because I usually get close. And if you have enough high explosives packed into the nose cone, close is good enough. Right now I see two possible endings to the book. One is very sad. The other, while not your standard Hollywood happy ending, at least holds out some hope for the future. Annie looked alarmed, and suddenly thunderous.
You're not thinking of killing her again, are you, Paul?
He smiled a little. What would you do if I did, Annie? Kill me? That doesn't scare me a bit. I may not know what's going to happen to Misery, but I know what's going to happen to me. And you. I'll write the end, and you'll read. And then you'll write the end, won't you? The end of us. That's one I don't have to guess at. Truth really isn't stranger than fiction, no matter what they say. Most times you know exactly how things are going to turn out. But I think I know which ending it's going to be. I'm about 80% sure. If it turns out that way, you'll like it. But even if it turns out the way I think, neither of us will know the actual details until I get them written down, will we? No, I suppose not. Do you remember what the old Greyhound bus ads used to say? Getting there is half the fun. Either way, it's almost over, isn't it? Yes, Paul said. Almost over. Before she left, she brought him another Pepsi, a box of Ritz crackers, sardines, cheese, and the bedpan. If you bring me my manuscript with one of those yellow legal pads, I'll work in longhand, he said. It will pass the time. She considered, then shook her head regretfully. I wish you could, Paul. But that would mean leaving at least one light on, and I can't risk it. He thought of being left alone down here in the cellar, and felt panic flush his skin again, but just for a moment. Then it went cold. He felt tiny, hard goosebumps rising on his skin. He thought of the rats hiding in their holes and runs in the rock walls. Thought of them coming out when the cellar went dark. Thought of them smelling his helplessness, perhaps. Don't leave me in the dark, Annie. Please don't do that.
I have to. If someone noticed a light in my cellar, they might stop to investigate. Driveway chain or no driveway chain, note or no note. If I gave you a flashlight, you might try to signal with it. If I gave you a candle, you might try to burn the house down with it. You see how well I know you?
He hardly dared mention the times he had gotten out of his room, because it always made her furious. Now his fear of being left alone down here in the dark drove him to it. If I had wanted to burn the house down, Annie, I could have done it long before this.
Things were different then, she said shortly. I'm sorry you don't like being left in the dark. I'm sorry you have to be. But it's your own fault, so quit being a brat. I've got to go. If you feel like you need that injection, stick it in your leg.
She looked at him.
Or stick it up your ass.
She started for the stairs.
Cover the windows, then!
He yelled after her.
Use some pieces of sheet or paint them black! Or Christ, Annie, the rats! The rats!
She was on the third stair. She paused, looking at him from those dusty dime eyes.
I haven't time to do any of those things, she said. And the rats won't bother you anyway. They may even recognize you for one of their own, Paul. They may adopt you.
Annie laughed. She climbed the stairs, laughing harder and harder. There was a click as the lights went out, and Annie went on laughing, and he told himself he wouldn't scream, wouldn't beg, that he was past all that. But the damp wildness of the shadows and the boom of her laughter were too much, and he shrieked for her not to do this to him, not to leave him. But she only went on laughing, and there was a click as the door was shut, and her laughter was muted, but her laughter was still there. Her laughter was on the other side of the door, where there was light. And then the lock clicked, and then another door closed, and her laughter was even more muted, but still there. And another lock clicked, and a bolt slammed, and her laughter was going away. Her laughter was outside. And even after she had started the cruiser up, backed out, put the chain across the driveway and driven away, he thought he could still hear her laughing and laughing and laughing. The furnace was a dim bulk in the middle of the room. It looked like an octopus. He thought he would have been able to hear the chiming of the parlor clock if the night had been still, but a strong summer wind had blown up, as it so often did these nights, and there was only time spreading out forever. He could hear crickets singing just outside the house when the wind dropped, and then, some time later, he heard the stealthy noises he had been afraid of, the low, momentary scuff and scurry of the rats. Only it wasn't the rats he was afraid of, was it? No. It was the trooper. His so fucking vivid imagination rarely gave him the horrors, but when it did, God help him. God help him once it was warmed up. It was not only warmed up now, it was hot and running on full choke. That there was no sense at all in what he was thinking made not a whit of difference in the dark. In the dark, rationality seemed stupid and logic a dream. In the dark, he thought with his skin. He kept seeing the trooper coming back to life, some sort of life, out in the barn, sitting up, the loose hay with which Annie had covered him, falling to either side of him and into his lap, his face plowed into bloody senselessness by the mower's blade. Saw him crawling out of the barn and down the driveway to the bulkhead, the torn streamers of his uniform swinging and fluttering. Saw him melting magically through the bulkhead and reintegrating his corpse's body down here. Saw him crawling across the packed dirt floor. And the little noises Paul heard weren't rats, but the sound of his approach. And there was but a single thought in the cooling clay of the trooper's dead brain. You killed me. You opened your mouth and killed me. You threw an ashtray and killed me. You cock-a-doodie son of a bitch, you murdered my life. Once Paul felt the trooper's dead fingers slip, tickling down his cheek, and he screamed loudly, jerking his legs and making them bellow. He brushed frantically at his face and knocked away not fingers, but a large spider. The movement ended the uneasy truce with a pain in his legs and the drug need in his nerves, but it also diffused his terror a little. His night vision was coming on strong now. He could see better, and that was a help. Not that there was much to look at. The furnace, the remains of a coal pile, a table with a bunch of shadowy cans and implements lying on it. And to his right, up away from where he was propped. What was that shape? The one next to the shelves. He knew that shape. Something about it that made it a bad shape. It stood on three legs. Its top was rounded. It looked like one of Wells's death machines in The War of the Worlds, only in miniature. Paul puzzled over this, dozed a little, woke, looked again and thought, "Of course. I should have known from the first. It is a death machine." And if anyone on Earth's a Martian, it's Annie fucking Wilkes. It's her barbecue pot. It's the crematorium where she made me burn fast cars. He shifted a little because his ass was going to sleep, and moaned. Pain in his legs, particularly in the bunched remains of his left knee, and pain in his pelvis as well. That probably meant he was in for a really bad night, because his pelvis had gotten pretty quiet over the last 2 months. He felt for the hypo, picked it up, then put it back. A very light dose, she had said. Best to save it for later, then. He heard a light shuffle-scuffle and looked quickly in the corner, expecting to see the trooper crawling toward him, one brown eye peering from the hash of his face. If not for you, I could be home watching TV now, with my hand on my wife's leg. No cop. A dim shape which was maybe just imagination, but was more likely a rat. Paul willed himself to relax. Oh, what a long night this was going to be. He dozed a little, and woke up slumped far over to the left, with his head hung down like a drunk in an alley. He straightened up, and his legs cursed him roundly. He used the bedpan, and it hurt to piss, and he realized with some dismay that a urinary infection was probably setting in. He was so vulnerable now, so fucking vulnerable to everything. He put the urinal aside and picked up the hypo again. A light dose of scopolamine, she said. Well, maybe so. Or maybe she loaded it with a hot shot of something, the sort of stuff she used on folks like Ernie Gagner and Queenie Bulafont. Then he smiled a little. Would that really be so bad? The answer was a resounding hell no. It would be good. The pilings would disappear forever. No more low tide. Forever. With that thought in mind, he found the pulse in his left thigh, and though he had never injected himself in his life, he did it efficiently now, even eagerly. He did not die and he did not sleep. The pain went away, and he drifted, feeling almost untethered from his body, a balloon of thought drifting at the end of a long string. You were also Scheherazade to yourself, he thought, and looked at the barbecue pot. He thought of Martian death rays burning London in fire. He thought suddenly of a song, a disco tune, something by a group called the Tramps. Burn, baby, burn. Burn the mother down. Something flickered. Some idea. Burn the mother down. Paul Sheldon slept. When he woke up, the cellar was filled with the ashy light of dawn. A very large rat sat on the tray Annie had left him, nibbling cheese with its tail neatly curled around its body. Paul screamed, jerked, then screamed again as pain flowed up his legs. The rat fled. She had left him some capsules. He knew that the Novril wouldn't take care of the pain, but it was better than nothing. Besides, pain or no pain, it's time for the old morning fix, right, Paul? He washed two of the caps down with Pepsi, and then leaned back, feeling the dull throb in his kidneys. He was growing something down there, all right. Great. Martians, he thought. Martian death machines. He looked toward the barbecue pot, expecting it to look like a barbecue pot in the morning light. A barbecue pot and nothing else. He was surprised to find it still looked to him like one of Wells's striding machines of destruction. You had an idea. What was it? The song came back, the one by the Tramps. Burn, baby, burn. Burn the mother down. Yeah? And just what mother is that? She wouldn't even leave you a candle. You couldn't light a fart. Up came a message from the boys in the sweatshop. You don't need to burn anything now. Or here. What the fuck are we talking about, guys? Could you let me in on? Then it came. It came at once. The way all the really good ideas came. Rounded and smooth and utterly persuasive in its baleful perfection. Burn the mother down. He looked at the barbecue pot, expecting the pain of what he had done, what she had made him do, to return. It did, but it was dull and faint,
The pain in his kidneys was worse. What had she said yesterday? All I ever did was talk you out of a bad book you'd written and into the best one you ever wrote. Maybe there was a queer sort of truth in that. Maybe he had widely overestimated just how good fast cars had been. That's just your mind trying to heal itself, part of him whispered. If you ever get out of this, you'll work yourself around in much the same fashion to thinking you never needed your left foot anyway. Hell, 5 less nails to clip. And they do wonders with prosthetics these days. No, Paul. One was a damn good book, and the other was a damn good foot. Let's not kid ourselves. Yet a deeper part of him suspected that to think that way was kidding himself. Not kidding yourself, Paul. Tell the goddamn truth. Lying to yourself. A guy who makes up stories, a guy like that is lying to everyone. So that guy can't ever lie to himself. It's funny, but it's also the truth. Once you start that shit, you might as well just cover up your typewriter and start studying for a broker's license or something, 'cause you're down the toilet. So what was the truth? The truth, should you insist, was that the increasing dismissal of his work in the critical press as that of a popular writer, which was, as he understood it, one step, a small one, above that of a hack, had hurt him quite badly. It didn't jibe with his self-image as a serious writer, who was only churning out these shitty romances in order to subsidize his flourish of trumpets, please, real work. Had he hated misery? Had he really? If so, why had it been so easy to slip back into her world? No more than easy. Blissful. Like slipping into a warm bath with a good book by one hand and a cold beer by the other. Perhaps all he had hated was the fact that her face on the dust jackets had overshadowed his in his author photographs, not allowing the critics to see that they were dealing with a young male or achiever here, that they were dealing with a heavyweight here. As a result, hadn't his serious fiction become steadily more self-conscious, a sort of scream? Look at me. Look how good this is. Hey, guys, this stuff has got a sliding perspective. This stuff has got stream-of-consciousness interludes. This is my real work, you assholes. Don't you dare turn away from me. Don't you dare, you cock-a-doodle brats. Don't you dare turn away from my real work. Don't you dare, or I'll... What? What would he do? Cut off their feet? Saw off their thumbs? Paul was seized by a sudden fit of shivering. He had to urinate. He grabbed the bedpan and finally managed, although it hurt worse than before. He moaned while he was pissing, and continued moaning for a long while after it was done. Finally, mercifully, the Novril began to kick in, a little, and he drowsed. He looked at the barbecue pot with heavy-lidded eyes. How would you feel if she made you burn Misery's Return? The interior voice whispered, and he jumped a little. Drifting away, he realized that it would hurt, yes, it would hurt terribly. It would make the pain he had felt when fast cars went up in smoke look like the pain of this kidney infection, compared with what he had felt when she brought the axe down, cutting off his foot, exercising editorial authority over his body. He also realized that wasn't the real question. The real question was how it would make Annie feel. There was a table near the barbecue pot. There were maybe half a dozen jars and cans on it. One was a can of charcoal lighter fluid. What if Annie was the one screaming in pain? Are you curious about how that might sound? Are you curious at all? The proverb says revenge is a dish best eaten cold, but Ronson Fastlight had yet to be invented when they made that one up. Paul thought, burn the mother down, and fell asleep. There was a little smile on his pale and fading face. When Annie arrived back at 3:15 that afternoon, her normally frizzy hair flattened around her head in the shape of the helmet she had been wearing, she was in a silent mood that seemed to indicate tiredness and reflection rather than depression. When Paul asked her if everything had gone all right, she nodded.
"Yes, I think so. I had some trouble starting the bike, or I would have been back an hour ago. The plugs were dirty. How are your legs, Paul? Do you want another shot before I take you upstairs?"
After almost 20 hours in the dampness, his legs felt as if someone had studded them with rusty nails. He wanted a shot very badly, but not down here. That would not do at all. "I think I'm all right." She turned her back to him and squatted.
"All right, grab on. But remember what I said about chokeholds and things like that. I'm very tired, and I don't think I'd react very well to funny jokes."
"I seem to be all out of jokes."
"Good."
She lifted him with a moist grunt, and Paul had to bite back a scream of agony. She walked across the floor toward the stairs, her head turned slightly, and he realized she was, or might be, looking at the can-littered table. Her glance was short, seemingly casual, but to Paul it seemed to go on for a very long time, and he was sure she would realize the can of lighter fluid was no longer there. It was stuffed down the back of his underpants instead. Long months after his earlier depredations, he had finally summoned up the courage to steal something else. And if her hand slipped up his legs as she climbed the stairs, she was going to grab more than a handful of his skinny ass. Then she glanced away from the table with no change of expression, and his relief was so great that the thudding, shifting ascent up the stairs to the pantry was almost bearable. She kept up a very good poker face when she wanted to, but he thought, hoped, that he had fooled her. That this time he had really fooled her.
"I guess I'd like that shot after all, Annie," he said when she had him back in bed. She studied his white, sweat-beaded face for a moment, then nodded and left the room. As soon as she was gone, he slid the flat can out of his underwear and under the mattress. He had not put anything under there since the knife, and he did not intend to leave the lighter fluid there long, but it would have to stay there for the rest of the day. Tonight he intended to put it in another, safer place. She came back and gave him an injection. Then she put a steno pad and some freshly sharpened pencils on the windowsill, and rolled his wheelchair over so it was by the bed.
"There," she said. "I'm going to get some sleep. If a car comes in, I'll hear it. If we're left alone, I'll probably sleep right through until tomorrow morning. If you want to get up and work in longhand, here's your chair. Your manuscript is over there on the floor. I frankly don't advise it until your legs start to warm up a little, though."
"I couldn't write now, but I guess I'll probably soldier along a while tonight."
"I understand what you meant about time being short now."
"I'm glad you do, Paul. How long do you think you need?"
"Under ordinary circumstances, I'd say a month. The way I've been working just lately, 2 weeks. If I really go into overdrive, 5 days, or maybe a week. It'll be ragged, but it'll be there." She sighed and looked down at her hands with dull concentration.
"I know it's going to be less than 2 weeks."
"I wish you'd promise me something." She looked at him, with no anger or suspicion, only faint curiosity.
"What?"
"Not to read any more until I'm done. Or until I have to, you know."
"Stop?"
"Yes. Or until I have to stop. That way you'll get the conclusion without a lot of fragmentation. It'll have a lot more punch."
"It's going to be a good one, isn't it?"
"Yes," Paul smiled. "It's going to be very hot stuff." That night, around 8:00, he hoisted himself carefully into the wheelchair. He listened and heard nothing at all from upstairs. He had been hearing the same nothing ever since the squeak of the bedsprings announced her lying down at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. She really must have been tired. Paul got the lighter fluid and rolled across to the spot by the window where his informal little writer's camp was pitched. Here was the typewriter with the 3 missing teeth in its unpleasant grin. Here the wastebasket. Here the pencils and pads and typing paper and piles of scrap rewrite, some of which he would use and some of which would go into the wastebasket. Or would have before. Here, all unseen, was the door to another world. Here, too, he thought, was his own ghost in a series of overlays, like still pictures, which, when riffled rapidly, give the illusion of movement. He wove the chair between the piles of paper and the casually stacked pads, with the ease of long practice, listened once more, then reached down and pulled out a 9-inch section of the baseboard. He had discovered it was loose about a month ago, and he could see by the thin film of dust on it. Next you'll be taping hairs across it yourself just to make sure, he had thought, that Annie hadn't known this loose piece of board was here. Behind it was a narrow space, empty save for dust, and a plentiful scattering of mouse turds. He stowed the can of Fastlight in the space and pushed the board back into place. He had an anxious moment when he was afraid it would no longer fit flush against its mates, and God, her eyes were so fucking sharp. And then it slipped neatly home. Paul regarded this for a moment, then opened his pad, picked up a pencil, and found the hole in the paper. He wrote undisturbed for the next 4 hours, until the points on all 3 of the pencils she had sharpened for him were written flat, and then he rolled himself back to the bed, got in, and went easily off to sleep. Chapter 37. Jeffrey's arms were beginning to feel like white iron. He had been standing in the deep shadows outside the hut which belonged to Machibi, beautiful one, for the last 5 minutes, looking rather like a too slim version of the circus strongman, with a baroness's trunk poised over his head. Just as he came to believe that nothing Hezekiah could say would convince Machibi to leave his hut, he heard sounds of movement. Jeffrey turned even farther, the muscles in his arms now twitching wildly. Chief Machibi, beautiful one, was the keeper of the fire, and inside his hut were better than 100 torches, the head of each coated with a thick, gummy resin. The resin oozed from the low trees of the area, and the Borkas called it fire oil, or fire blood oil. Like most essentially simple languages, that of the Borkas could at times be oddly elusive. Whatever you call the stuff, however, there were enough torches in there to set this whole village afire. It would burn like a Guy Fawkes dummy, Jeffrey thought. If, that was, Machibi could be gotten out of the way. "Thee are not to strike, boss Jeffrey," Hezekiah had said. "Machibi he come out first one, 'cause he be the fireman. Hezekiah he be coming out second one. So don't you be waiting to see my gold two flash. You break that brat's head damn quick." But when he actually did hear them coming, Jeffrey felt a moment's doubt in spite of the agony in his arms. Suppose that just this once, the oh. His pencil paused in mid-word at the sound of an approaching engine. He was surprised at how calm he felt. The strongest emotion in him right now was mild annoyance at being interrupted just when it was starting to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. Annie's boot heels rattled staccato down the hallway. "Get out of sight." Her face was tight and grim. The khaki bag, unzipped, was over her shoulder. "Get out of sight." She paused, and saw that he had already rolled the wheelchair back from the window. She looked to make sure that none of his things were on the sill, then nodded. "It's the state police," she said. She looked tense but in control. The shoulder bag was within easy reach of her right hand. "Are you going to be good, Paul?" "Yes," he said. Her eyes searched his face. "I'm going to trust you," she said finally,
and turned away, closing the door but not bothering to lock it. The car turned into the driveway, the smooth, sleepy beat of that big 442 Plymouth engine almost like a trademark. He heard the kitchen screen door bang shut and eased the wheelchair close enough to the window so he could remain in an angle of shadow and still peek out. The cruiser pulled up to where Annie stood, and the engine died. The driver got out and stood almost exactly where the young trooper had been standing when he spoke his last four words, but there all resemblance ended. That trooper had been a weedy young man hardly out of his teens, a rookie cop pulling a shit detail, chasing the cold trail of some numbnuts rider who had wrecked up his car and then either staggered deeper into the woods to die or walked blithely away from the whole mess with his thumb cocked. The cop currently unfolding himself from behind the cruiser's wheel was about 40, with shoulders seemingly as wide as a barn beam. His face was a square of granite with a few narrow lines carved into it at the eyes and the corners of the mouth. Annie was a big woman, but this fellow made her look almost small. There was another difference as well. The trooper Annie killed had been alone. Getting out of the shotgun seat of this cruiser was a small, slope-shouldered plainclothesman with lank blonde hair. David and Goliath, Paul thought. Mutt and Jeff. Jesus. The plainclothesman did not so much walk around the cruiser as mince around it. His face looked old and tired, the face of a man who is half asleep, except for his faded blue eyes. The eyes were wide awake, everywhere at once. Paul thought he would be quick. They bookended Annie, and she was saying something to them, first looking up to speak to Goliath, then half-turning and looking down to reply to David. Paul wondered what would happen if he broke the window again and screamed for help again. He thought the odds were maybe 8 in 10 that they would take her. Oh, she was quick, but the big cop looked as if he might be quicker in spite of his size, and strong enough to uproot middling-sized trees with his bare hands. The plainclothesman's self-conscious walk might be as deliberately deceptive as his sleepy look. He thought they would take her. Except what surprised them wouldn't surprise her, and that gave her an outside chance anyway. The plainclothesman's coat. It was buttoned in spite of the glaring heat. If she shot Goliath first, she might very well be able to put a slug in David's face before he could get that oogie goddamn coat unbuttoned and his gun out. More than anything else, that buttoned coat suggested that Annie had been right. So far, this was just a routine checkback. So far. I didn't kill him, you know. You killed him. If you had kept your mouth shut, I would have sent him on his way. He'd be alive now. Did he believe that? No, of course not. But there was still that strong, hurtful moment of guilt, like a quick, deep stab wound. Was he going to keep his mouth shut because there were 2 chances in 10 that she would off these 2 as well if he opened it? The guilt stabbed quickly again and was gone. The answer to that was also no. It would be nice to credit himself with such selfless motives, but it wasn't the truth. The fact was simple. He wanted to take care of Annie Wilkes himself. "They could only put you in jail, bitch," he thought. "I know how to hurt you." There was always the possibility, of course, that they would smell a rat. Rat catching was, after all, their job, and they would know Annie's background. If that was the way things turned out, so be it. But he thought Annie might just be able to wriggle past the law this one last time. Paul now knew as much of the story as he needed to know, he supposed. Annie had listened to the radio constantly since her long sleep, and the missing state cop, whose name was Duane Kushner, was big news. The fact that he had been searching for traces of a hotshot writer named Paul Sheldon was reported, but Kushner's disappearance had not been linked, even speculatively, with Paul's own. At least not yet. The spring runoff had sent his Camaro rolling and tumbling 5 miles down the wash.
It might have lain undiscovered in the forest for another month or another year, but for merest coincidence. A couple of National Guard chopper jockeys sent out as part of a random drug control sweep, looking for backcountry pot farmers, in other words, had seen a sunflash on what remained of the Camaro's windshield, and set down in a nearby clearing for a closer look. The seriousness of the crash itself had been masked by the violent battering the Camaro had taken as it traveled to its final resting place. If the car had yielded traces of blood to forensic analysis, if indeed there had been a forensic analysis, the radio did not say so. Paul knew that even an exhaustive analysis would turn up precious few traces of blood. His car had spent most of the spring with snowmelt running through it at flood speed. And in Colorado, most of the attention and concern were focused on Trooper Duane Kushner, as he supposed these two visitors proved. So far, all speculation centered on three illegal substances: moonshine, marijuana, and cocaine. It seemed possible that Kushner might have stumbled across the growing, distilling, or stockpiling of one of these substances quite by accident during his search for signs for the Tenderfoot Rider. And as hope of finding Kushner alive began to fade, questions about why he had been out there alone in the first place began to grow louder. And while Paul doubted if the state of Colorado had money enough to finance a buddy system for its vehicle police, they were obviously combing the area for Kushner in pairs, taking no chances. Goliath now gestured toward the house. Annie shrugged and shook her head. David said something. After a moment, she nodded and led them up the path to the kitchen door. Paul heard the screen's hinges squeak, and then they were in. The sound of so many footfalls out there was frightening, almost a profanation.
"What time was it when he came by?"
Goliath asked. It had to be Goliath. He had a rumbling Midwestern voice, roughened by cigarettes. "Around 4," Annie said, give or take. She had just finished mowing the grass and she didn't wear a watch. It had been devilish hot. She remembered that well enough.
"How long did he stay, Mrs. Wilkes?"
David asked.
"It's Miss Wilkes, if you don't mind."
"Excuse me." Annie said she couldn't reckon on how long for sure, only it hadn't been long, 5 minutes maybe.
"He showed you a picture?"
"Yes," Annie said. "That was why he came." Paul marveled at how composed she sounded, how pleasant.
"And had you seen the man in the picture?"
Annie said certainly. He was Paul Sheldon. She knew that right away.
"I have all his books," she said. "I like them very much." That disappointed Officer Kushner. He said if that was the case, he guessed I probably knew what I was talking about. He looked very discouraged. He also looked very hot.
"Yeah, it was a hot day, all right," Goliath said.
And Paul was alarmed by how much closer his voice was. "In the parlor?" "Yes, almost certainly in the parlor." Big or not, the guy moved like a goddamn lynx. When Annie responded, her own voice was closer. The cops had moved into the parlor. She was following. She hadn't asked them, but they had gone in there anyway, looking the place over. Although her pet writer was now less than 35 feet away, Annie's voice remained composed. She had asked if he would like to come in for an iced coffee. He said he couldn't. So she had asked if he'd like to take along a cold bottle of...
"Please don't break that!"
Annie interrupted herself, her voice sharpening.
"I like my things, and some of them are quite fragile."
"Sorry, ma'am." That had to be David, his voice low and whispery, both humble and a little startled. That tone coming from a cop would have been amusing under other circumstances. But these were not other circumstances, and Paul was not amused. He sat stiffly, hearing the small sound of something being set carefully back down. The penguin on his block of ice, perhaps. His hands clasped tightly on the arms of the wheelchair. He imagined her fiddling with a shoulder bag. He waited for one of the cops, Goliath probably,
to ask her just what the hell it was she had in there. Then the shooting would start.
"What were you saying?" David asked.
"That I asked him if he'd like to take along a cold Pepsi from the fridge, because it was such a hot day. I keep them right next to the freezer compartment, and that keeps them as cold as you can get them without freezing them. He said that would be very kind. He was a very polite boy. Why do they let such a young boy out alone, do you know?"
"Did he drink the soda here?" David asked, ignoring her question. His voice was closer still. He had crossed the parlor. Paul didn't have to close his eyes to imagine him standing there, looking down the short hall which passed the little downstairs bathroom and ended in the closed guest room door. Paul sat tight and upright, a pulse beating rapidly in his scrawny throat.
"No," Annie said, as composed as ever. "He took it along. He said he had to keep rolling."
"What's down there?" Goliath asked. There was a double thud of booted heels, the sound slightly hollow, as he stepped off the parlor carpet and onto the bare boards of the hallway.
"A bath and a spare bedroom. I sometimes sleep there when it's very hot. Have a look if you like, but I promise I don't have your trooper tied to the bed."
"No, ma'am. I'm sure you don't," David said, and amazingly their footfalls and voices began to fade toward the kitchen again.
"Did he seem excited about anything while he was here?"
"Not at all," Annie said. "Just hot and discouraged." Paul was beginning to breathe again.
"Preoccupied about anything?"
"No."
"Did he say where he was going next?"
Although the cops almost surely missed it, Paul's own practiced ear sensed the minutest of hesitations. There could be a trap here, a snare which might spring at once or after a short delay. "No," she said at last, although he had headed west, so she assumed he must have gone toward Springer's Road and the few farms out that way.
"Thank you, ma'am, for your cooperation," David said. "We may have to check back with you."
"All right," Annie said. "Feel free. I don't see much company these days."
"Would you mind if we looked in your barn?" Goliath asked abruptly.
"Not at all. Just be sure to say howdy when you go in."
"Howdy to who, ma'am?" David asked.
"Why, to Misery," Annie said. "My pig."
She stood in the doorway looking at him fixedly, so fixedly that his face began to feel warm, and he supposed he was blushing. The two cops had left 15 minutes ago.
"You see something green?" he asked finally.
"Why didn't you holler?"
Both cops had tipped their hats to her as they got in the cruiser, but neither had smiled. And there had been a look in their eyes Paul had been able to see, even from the narrow angle afforded by the corner of his window. They knew who she was, all right.
"I kept expecting you to holler. It would have fallen on me like an avalanche."
"Maybe, maybe not."
"But why didn't you?"
"Annie, if you spend your whole life thinking the worst thing you can imagine is going to happen, you have to be wrong some of the time."
"Don't be smart with me."
He saw that beneath her assumed impassivity, she was deeply confused. His silence did not fit well into her view of all existence as a sort of big-time wrestling match. Honest Annie versus that all-time double-ugly tag team of the cock-a-doodle brats.
"Who's being smart? I told you I was going to keep my mouth shut, and I did. I want to finish my book in relative peace, and I want to finish it for you."
She looked at him uncertainly, wanting to believe, afraid to believe, and ultimately believing anyway. And she was right to believe, because he was telling the truth.
"Get busy, then," she said softly. "Get busy right away. You saw the way they looked at me."
For the next 2 days, life went on just as it had before Duane Kushner.
It was almost possible to believe Duane Kushner had never happened at all. Paul wrote almost constantly. He had given the typewriter up for the nonce. Annie put it on the mantel below the picture of the Arc de Triomphe without comment. He filled 3 legal pads in those 2 days. There was only one left. When he had filled that one, he would move on to the steno pads. She sharpened his half-dozen Barrel Black Warrior pencils. He wrote them dull, and Annie sharpened them again. They shrank steadily as he sat in the sun by the window, bent over, sometimes scratching absently with a great toe of his right foot at the air where the sole of his left foot had been, looking through the hole in the paper. It had yawned wide open again, and the book rushed toward its climax the way the best ones did, as if on a rocket sled. He saw everything with perfect clarity, 3 groups all hell-bent for misery in the crenellated passages behind the idol's forehead, 2 wanting to kill her, the 3rd consisting of Ian, Jeffrey, and Hezekiah, trying to save her. While below, the village of the Burkas burned, and the survivors massed at the 1 point of egress, the idol's left ear, to massacre anyone who happened to stagger out alive. This hypnotic state of absorption was rudely shaken, but not broken, when on the 3rd day after the visit of David and Goliath, a cream-colored Ford station wagon with KTKA Grand Junction written on the side pulled into Annie's driveway. The back was full of video equipment. "Oh, God," Paul said, frozen somewhere between humor, amazement, and horror. "What's this, fuckerow?" The wagon had barely stopped before one of the rear doors flew open, and a guy dressed in combat fatigue pants and a deadhead T-shirt leaped out. There was something big and black, pistol gripped in one hand, and for one wild moment Paul thought it was a tear gas gun. Then he raised it to his shoulder and swept it toward the house, and Paul saw it was a minicam. A pretty young woman was getting out of the front passenger seat, fluffing her blow-dried hair, and pausing for one final appraising look at her makeup in the outside rearview mirror before joining her cameraman. The eye of the outside world, which had slipped away from the dragon lady these last few years, had now returned with a vengeance. Paul rolled backward quickly, hoping he had been in time. "Well, if you want to know for sure, just check the 6 o'clock news," he thought, and then had to raise both hands to his mouth to plug up the giggles. The screen door banged open and shut.
"Get the hell out of here!"
Annie screamed.
"Get the hell off my land!"
Dimly.
"Miss Wilkes, if we could just have a few..."
"You can have a couple of loads of double-aught fuck up your cock-a-doodie bumhole if you don't get out of here!"
"Miss Wilkes, I'm Glenna Roberts from KTKA."
"I don't care if you're John Q. Jesus Johnny K. Christ from the planet Mars! Get off my land or you're dead!"
"But..."
"Kapow!"
"Oh, Annie, oh my Jesus, Annie killed that stupid broad." He rolled back and peeked through the window. He had no choice. He had to see. Relief gusted through him. Annie had fired into the air. That seemed to have done quite well. Glenna Roberts was diving headfirst into the KTKA newsmobile. The cameraman swung his lens toward Annie. Annie swung her shotgun toward the cameraman. The cameraman, deciding he wanted to live to see the Grateful Dead again more than he wanted to roll tape on the Dragon Lady, immediately dropped into the back seat again. The wagon was reversing down the driveway before he got his door all the way closed. Annie stood watching them go, the rifle held in one hand, and then she came slowly back into the house. He heard the clack as she put the rifle on the table. She came down to Paul's room. She looked worse than he had ever seen her, her face haggard and pale, her eyes darting constantly.
"They're back," she whispered.
"Take it easy."
"I knew all those brats would come back, and now they have."
"They're gone, Annie. You made them go."
"They never go. Someone told them that cop was at the Dragon Lady's house before he disappeared. So here they are."
"Annie."
"You know what they want?"
she demanded. "Of course, I've dealt with the press. They want the same 2 things they always want.
for you to fuck up while the tape's running, and for someone else to buy the martinis when happy hour rolls around. But, Annie, you've got to settle to...
This is what they want, she said,
and raised one hooked hand to her forehead. She pulled down suddenly, sharply, opening four bloody furrows. Blood ran into her eyebrows, down her cheeks, along either side of her nose. Annie, stop it.
And this!
She slapped herself across the left cheek with her left hand, hard enough to leave an imprint.
And this!
The right cheek, even harder, hard enough to make droplets of blood fly from the fingernail gouges.
Stop it!
He screamed.
It's what they want!
She screamed back. She raised her hands to her forehead and pressed them against the wounds, blotting them. She held her bloody palms out toward him for a moment. Then she plodded out of the room. After a long, long time, Paul began to write again. It went slowly at first. The image of Annie pulling those furrows into her skin kept intruding, and he thought it was going to be no good. He had just better pack it in for the day, when the story caught him, and he fell through the hole in the paper again. As always these days, he went with a sense of blessed relief. More police came the next day, local yokels this time. With them was a skinny man carrying a case which could only contain a steno machine. Annie stood in the driveway with them, listening, her face expressionless. Then she led them into the kitchen. Paul sat quietly, a steno pad of his own in his lap. He had finished the last legal pad the previous evening, and listened to Annie's voice as she made a statement which consisted of all the things she had told David and Goliath 4 days ago. This, Paul thought, was nothing more than blatant harassment. He was amused and appalled to find himself feeling a little sorry for Annie Wilkes. The Sidewinder cop who asked most of the questions began by telling Annie she could have a lawyer present if she wanted. Annie declined and simply retold her story. Paul could detect no deviations. They were in the kitchen for half an hour. Near the end, one of them asked how she had come by the ugly-looking scratches on her forehead.
I did it in the night, she said. I had a bad dream.
What was that? The cop asked.
I dreamed that people remembered me after all this time and started coming out here again, Annie said.
When they were gone, Annie came to his room. Her face was doughy and distant and ill.
This place is turning into Grand Central, Paul said.
She didn't smile.
How much longer?
He hesitated, looked at the pile of typescript with a ragged stack of handwritten pages on top, then back at Annie.
2 days, he said. Maybe three.
The next time they come, they'll have a search warrant, she said,
and left before he could reply. She came in that evening around 11:45 and said,
You should have been in bed an hour ago, Paul.
He looked up, startled out of the story's deep dream. Jeffrey, who had turned out to be very much the hero of this one, had just come face to face with a hideous queen bee, whom he would have to battle to the death for Misery's life. It doesn't matter, he said. I'll turn in after a while. Sometimes you get it down or it gets away. He shook his hand, which was sore and throbbing. A large, hard growth, half callous and half blister, had risen on the inside of his index finger, where the pencil pressed most firmly. He had pills, and they would take away the pain, but they would also blur his thoughts.
You think it's good, don't you? She asked softly.
Really good. You're not just doing it for me anymore, are you?
Oh, no, he said. For a moment he trembled on the edge of saying something more, of saying it was never for you, Annie, or all the other people out there who signed their letters your number one fan. The minute you start to write, all those people are at the other end of the galaxy or something. It was never for my ex-wives or my mother or my father. The reason authors almost always put a dedication on a book, Annie, is because their selfishness even horrifies themselves in the end.